Jerry Rubin lived in Avondale here in Cincinnati in the 1950s and early 60s. His father drove a bakery delivery truck. His mother graduated from UC. He went to Walnut Hills High School and loved the Cincinnati Reds. Rubin was raised in a typical all-American middle-class family. Pat Thomas has written not only a biography of Jerry Rubin, but also a detailed backstory of the major political protests during those years. Pat, thanks for this great book, which is so well researched.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here in Cincinnati, which of course is Jerry Rubin's hometown, and who knew that would birth one of the great radicals of the 60s.
Did you spend much time here in Cincinnati researching?
No, Cincinnati came to me because Jerry never threw anything out. So all of Jerry's journals and memorabilia and ephemera from Cincinnati was all sitting in LA in a box, several boxes.
And Gil, you were Jerry's brother. Welcome, too.
Nice to be here with you.
So I'm wondering, what happened to all of his personal effects after he passed?
Well, as Pat mentioned, there's a lot in California, and there are a couple boxes in my basement, actually.
And that's where you got some of your research, because you talked to a lot of people.
Well, when Jerry tragically died, he got hit by a car in 1994. He was divorced from his wife and mother of his children, but they were close friends. And so after he died, she literally went into the apartment and just put everything in boxes. And so I had, you know, whatever newspapers Jerry was looking at, you know, the day he died. He also had every canceled check going back to 1970. He used to be a reporter here for the Cincinnati Post. He had saved every article he'd ever written. So I literally went through maybe 15,000 items.
Wow, you hit the jackpot with that, didn't you?
Right. And then Mimi Leonard, who was married to Jerry in the 80s and 90s, she took out a Rolodex and she just started calling people. And so I wound up talking to almost 100 people.
I saw a photograph that you had in the book of his Rolodex, his address book.
Well, you know, Jerry, you know, he kind of invented the idea of social networking. So Jerry had Bob Dylan's phone number, Dick Gregory, pretty much every major countercultural person of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You know, Jerry hung out at Studio 54, so he had Liza Minnelli's phone number, you know, you name it.
And he loved celebrities.
Yeah, he loved celebrity. He loved being a celebrity, which was probably both good and bad for his legacy.
You mentioned that when he'd go to an airport, he'd have himself paged.
Well, he did that notoriously here in Cincinnati when he came back for the weekend in the early 70s. You know, he would be Jerry Rubin to the white courtesy phone, Jerry Rubin to the white courtesy phone. Just let everybody know he's, you know, he's back in town.
And Gil, you were on the edge of his celebrity.
So I was the quiet fly on the wall during the revolution. And participated in all of the demonstrations and loved to tag along with Jerry because, as Pat mentioned, there certainly were a lot of celebrities hanging around Jerry. And it was just amazing to watch everything that was happening.
And after your parents died, he took you with him to California.
My mother died when I was 12. My father died when I was 13. Jerry was on his way to study in Lucknow, India at the time. And the State Department actually had to track him down in Europe at an airport. And he came back, and we lived together in Cincinnati for another year. Jerry went to UC. I was a ninth grader at Walnut Hills High School. And we lived together in Bond Hill. Jerry was my legal guardian. So we had a 23-year-old and a 13-year-old living together.
And you said you got into classical music.
So I was a classical musician and played the piano, started taking lessons with my mother when I was about 6 years old. In fact, I was allowed to come home early from Walnut Hills High School to leave school early and go home and practice, which I did occasionally.
Well, so how did Jerry Rubin end up in Berkeley in the 60s, where he began influencing the anti-protest, anti-war movements?
Well, you know, Jerry was always interested in politics. You know, as a teen, he loved Adlai Stevenson. He met Adlai and interviewed him as a high school kid. Jerry started listening to the radio in the early 60s. He not only was hearing rock and roll music, which inspired him, but he was hearing about the beginnings of the free speech movement at UC Berkeley. And so Jerry went out there as a grad student, brought Gil with him. And within weeks, Jerry dropped out of grad school and just got caught up in the whole beginnings of the anti-war movement. And Jerry co-founded something called the VDC, the Vietnam Day Committee. And when you see those pictures of the troop trains moving through Berkeley in the 60s on their way to the Port of Oakland to take the first batch of soldiers to Vietnam, it was Jerry and his buddies who were lying down on those troop tracks. So that's how Jerry got his initial start.
And he was an active part of organizing protests.
Well, he was very active. In fact, he was so active that he caught the notice of HUAC, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee, you know, famously run back in the day by commie hater Joe McCarthy. And Jerry put himself in the national newspapers in 1966 when he showed up in Congress wearing an American Revolutionary War uniform. You know, many other people had shown up and pleaded the fifth, I'm not going to talk. Jerry says, I'm eager to talk, you know, looking like Paul Revere. And it literally shut Congress down for the day. And that made national papers. At that point, you know, Jerry was a nationally known figure to the anti-war movement.
What spurred his move to New York City?
Well, Dave Dellinger, who was a famous pacifist going all the way back to World War II, later became a Chicago 8 defendant. Dave invited Jerry to New York and said, we're going to be marching on Washington in October 67. We'd like you to help lead this. A very unknown Abbie Hoffman, no one knew who Abbie Hoffman was, had seen Jerry in the paper wearing this Revolutionary War outfit, was eager to meet Jerry. And within days, Jerry and Abbie did their first Yippie stunt. They threw hundreds of $1 bills onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, totally shutting down trading for the rest of the day. And again, that put Jerry, and in this case, Abbie, on the map.
And you mentioned Yippie. What was a Yippie?
Well, Yippie was the Youth International Party. And, you know, this is the beginning of beards, long hair, smoking dope, taking LSD. These were politicized hippies.
That's the point. They were hippies, but in a different costume.
Well, in other words, you know, most Yippies want to listen to rock music and get laid. These guys wanted to do that as well as protest LBJ and Nixon.
And they were behind the Chicago demonstrations during the 68 Democratic Convention.
Well, that is probably the Yippies' biggest legacy, because the Democrats were refusing to get out of Vietnam, and the Yippies showed up along with other SDS, MOBY, other student groups, and, you know, tens of thousands of students came. And of course, there's the, you know, infamous scene of the cops literally smashing their heads in with batons on CBS News. And Walter Cronkite says, look what they're doing to our kids. And meanwhile, these kids are screaming, the whole world is watching. That leads to the Chicago 8 trial and makes Jerry Rubin, at that point, he is a household name.
What about Jerry's relationship with John Lennon and Yoko Ono?
Well, you know, John Lennon, of course, had written this song, Revolution, by the Beatles, which, interestingly enough, was released as a single on the first day of the Chicago riots in 68, just by coincidence. So John and Yoko were watching Jerry in 69 and 70. And when they moved to Manhattan in 71, the first person they wanted to meet was Jerry Rubin. And Jerry sort of energized them and said, let's kick Nixon out of office. Let's try to beat him in the 72 election. Let's get Bob Dylan to write some more protest songs. And so Jerry told Lennon about the plight of John Sinclair. John Sinclair was a radical activist. He was also the manager of a legendary rock band called the MC5. Sinclair was in prison for giving two joints to an undercover cop. So John Lennon and Yoko Ono and Jerry and a bunch of others, Stevie Wonder, for example, all went to Ann Arbor, Michigan, played a big concert, and the government thought, you know, this is drawing too much attention to us. We're going to let John Sinclair out of prison, which they did the Monday after the concert.
And that reminds me, didn't Jerry Rubin have a bodyguard at Chicago that was a Hell's Angel, but a cop?
Right. Well, yeah, there was a guy pretending to be a Hell's Angel. He was actually an undercover cop. Supposedly he was, he was following Jerry around. Jerry and him were interacting. But to show how thin the case was on the Chicago 8 trial, at one point, they brought up charges. Said, well, Jerry was aggressive. He threw a sweater at a policeman, right? I mean, the charges were so thin and so ridiculous.
And then it turned into the Chicago 7. I see lots of mentions of the Chicago 7 instead of 8.
Well, I like to say Chicago 8 because it's, to be honest, I think it's a little racist to remove Bobby Seale out of the history books just because he was, you know, he was literally chained and gagged to a chair by federal marshals. And finally, they tried him separately. But in my mind, it's the Chicago 8. In fact, if you ask members of the Chicago 8, they call it the Chicago 10 because their two lawyers were also indicted. So
the FBI were circling around Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin at the time.
Well, you know, the FBI were circling around everybody. J. Edgar Hoover was paranoid. And there's a lot of funny anecdotes in the book. One is Abbie Hoffman is using a payphone. He's talking to another radical. He runs out of change, and he realizes the payphone didn't stop working because the FBI had tapped it. They were keeping the line open. And finally, the FBI literally breaks in the conversation and goes, "I'm tired of hearing you pinko commies talk. This is vile and disgusting." It was very, very funny. You know, Dick Gregory tells a similar joke. He says, "I didn't pay my phone bill for 5 years. My phone never got turned off." Why? Because the FBI was tapping it. They didn't want it turned off.
And we just lost him.
Yeah, Dick died just a few weeks ago.
How did Jerry Rubin meet Abbie Hoffman?
As I mentioned earlier, Jerry had been on the front cover of the newspaper for dressing up in a Revolutionary War uniform in front of Congress. He'd been written about. So Abbie, from afar, was admiring Jerry's actions. They were making national news. And so, you know, when Jerry got to Manhattan in 67, you know, Abby's like, "I got to meet this guy." You know, now this is pre-internet, pre-Facebook, you know, they didn't text each other, but somehow freaks had a way of finding other freaks.
Right. And they stayed friends for a long time.
They stayed friends for a long time. And one of the things that my book talks about, there were these infamous yippie versus yuppie debates in the 80s. And they each said a lot of disparaging things about each other, but, you know, off camera, if you will, you know, these guys remained tight. One of the reasons why is Abbie had gone underground through most of the 70s. He trusted very few people. Jerry met with Abbie all the time in the 70s when Abbie was underground. And so even though he didn't like Jerry wearing a tie, he knew he could trust Jerry.
And Abbie had had plastic surgery.
He'd had plastic surgery paid for by Bert Schneider, who produced the Easy Rider film. You know, there's an incredible connection between progressive Hollywood and the radical movement.
And Abbie had been living up in upstate New York, still doing political things.
That's right. Abbie changed his name to Barry Freed and had even been honored in Congress by Senator Daniel Moynihan for doing great environmental work. You know, so, you know, Abbie was the ultimate prankster, right? He's actually wanted by the FBI, and he's getting a letter of commendation by U.S. Congress at the same time.
He was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
Yeah, for a long time. But, you know, Abbie was never violent. He was actually wanted for a cocaine drug deal that went bad. It's important to remember that Jerry and Abbie and the Yippies were not blowing up buildings. They weren't carrying guns. You know, it was all about pranking and humor and sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
And Gil, of course, you met lots of celebrities when he was out in California. Did you meet any of the folks that he was with in New York when he moved?
Yeah, I met very many of the friends that he had, and it was a lot of fun for a 20-year-old hanging around with that group. But I managed to avoid all of the danger.
Did you go to Studio 54?
So I did go to Studio 54, and I attended demonstrations. I attended some of the Chicago trial. But again, all of the fun, none of the danger.
And were you part of any of the social networking that he started doing?
No.
That was later on?
So that was later on, and we were on different coasts at that point.
Jerry hooked up with Lennon and Ono. They wanted to do a tour?
Yeah, I was mentioning that earlier. When John and Yoko left London and permanently moved to New York City in 1971, they sought out Rubin, knowing that he was a radical. And in fact, you know, there's this great meeting, Washington Square Park, where John and Yoko meet Jerry and Abbie. And Jerry and Abbie say, you know, "We always thought of you guys as great revolutionaries." And John and Yoko said, "Well, we thought of you guys as great artists." You know, Nixon was still in office. The 1972 election was coming up soon. And so the idea was, is that John and Yoko, the MC5, Jerry Rubin, Rennie Davis, another Chicago 8 member, ideally Dylan, although I don't think he ever would have done it, they were going to go from town to town playing free concerts. And the other thing was, Jerry and Abbie had influenced Congress to lower the voting age to 18. So there were a whole bunch of potential voters between the age of 18 and 21 who weren't registered yet. And so that was another key thing that Jerry wanted to do, was get all those kids to register and hopefully vote Nixon out of office.
In the music world, there were a lot of Lennon fans who blamed Jerry for Lennon's deterioration musically.
Well, there's a whole big part of my book about this. Last time I checked, John Lennon was an adult and was a free thinker.
Wasn't he also doing heroin?
Yeah, he was doing heroin. But my point is that, you know, Lennon was already politicized. He'd written a song called Power to the People. He'd written a song called Revolution. And so Jerry was educating him and inspiring him. And at the end of the day, you know, Lennon has to take responsibility. Obviously, he's dead now, but he needs to own his own politics. And I think one of the reasons that Lennon disowned Jerry is the only way that Nixon and Hoover could think of a way to get Lennon out of America was deport him. And so throughout the 70s, even though Lennon had gotten his green card, he was continuing to publicly badmouth Jerry to sort of, you know, let the government know, like, you know, I'm a clean-cut guy. And yet he was still hanging out and talking to Jerry privately.
And how did Jerry go from yippie to yuppie?
Well, you know, a lot of people thought that Nixon would get thrown out of office in 72. And when he didn't, when he won by landslide, a lot of the radicals of the 60s got very depressed. They realized that the 60s were truly over. And, you know, Jerry was in a depression. He could have easily become an alcoholic or a drug addict. Instead, he wisely drove from Manhattan to San Francisco, literally almost minutes after the election was over, shaved off his beard, got into therapy, yoga, health food, and kind of reinvented himself, recharged his batteries. I mean, you know, the 60s were tiring and exhausting. Get your head bashed in a few times with a baton, you might want to take a few years off. And Jerry also realized that he needed to reinvent himself. And one of the great horrible myths of Jerry Rubin's legacy is that he was a stockbroker. People act like he was selling shares in Exxon. No, Jerry was marketing solar panels and green energy on Wall Street in 1980. So he was not the devil.
And then did he meet Mimi?
He met Mimi Leonard, who was the daughter of George Leonard, one of the founders of Esalen, and again, part of the sort of what we call New Age movement of California in the 70s. But Jerry and Mimi came up with this incredible idea. And again, pre-LinkedIn, pre-Facebook, let's bring like-minded thinkers together. So let's say every Monday night at Studio 54, they threw a party. The first Monday of the month was for anyone who was a CPA and an accountant. The second Monday of the month might be for anyone who's an electrical engineer or a mechanical engineer. The third party might be for anyone who's in, you know, banking, right? And so people came together, they traded business cards, they got jobs. Jerry was using the word social networking, you know, 20, 30 years before the rest of us heard it.
Didn't they also copyright that?
They did own the copyright for that briefly, yeah.
That social networking worked well because of all his contacts. He knew everybody.
He knew everybody. You know, the other thing was, you know, my brother tells a story. My brother was on Wall Street in those years. And he said, you know, Jerry came in to his firm looking for a job. And they thought, Jerry's changed. He's a moderate Democrat. He's got a suit and a tie on. But we can't trust him. Maybe this is a prank. Jerry was unemployable, right? And so the only way Jerry could survive was to throw these parties. And then later, just before his death, he was selling vitamin drinks and health food and that thing. So people put Jerry down for being an entrepreneur, and yet no one wanted to give Jerry a job. So, you know, you can't have it both ways.
But wasn't he doing well before Black Monday in 87?
Yeah, he had done well. You know, I mean, I have his financial records, but that's not that exciting for me to go over. But yeah, you know, Black Monday hit a lot of people. Jerry and Mimi were thinking about starting a restaurant called Jerry's Place. Liza Minnelli was an investor. Anyway, that all went down the toilet bowl. And then he, as Gil mentioned, both of their parents died in their 50s. So Jerry was obsessed with longevity. He started reading longevity magazines. Jerry was determined to live, you know, 100 years if he could.
So he got into the New Age movement.
We got into the New Age movement. Jerry was a vegetarian throughout the late 70s and 80s. Like I said, his parents had died young, and so he was obsessed with not dying young. Ironically enough, he died at 56.
Moved back from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Right. He moved back to California. Mimi and him had split up, but they had two children together. They were still business partners and friends. And Jerry was selling this drink called Wow that was packed with vitamins and, my guess is, some caffeine.
So how long was he out there selling that drink before the car accident when he got hit?
I think he'd been in L.A. for about 4 years. He died in 1994, and he'd been out there for about 4 years. Jerry was, you know, on one hand, he'd been in Manhattan on and off through the 70s and 80s. On the other hand, he'd gone out with Gil to UC Berkeley in the 60s. I mean, Jerry was a very bi-coastal person. The one thing is, Jerry needed to be in the city. There's a funny story in the book about Mark Rudd of the Weather Underground. The mid-70s invited Jerry to speak at the University of New Mexico. And after the lecture, Mark wanted to show him the cactus and the desert. And they'd been out there for about 4 minutes. And Jerry goes, please, please, please bring me back to civilization.
Did you notice that about him, Gil?
He was very much a city person. Because if you're in the desert, no one's going to recognize you.
Whoa, Gil, that's great.
So where were you when he passed away?
So I was a dentist in Connecticut, and I got a phone call from Mimi, and immediately flew out to California.
He was in a coma for a couple of weeks?
He was in a coma for several weeks, and that became a little bit of a circus because it was in the papers, and so there's a couple of stories. One is Eldridge Cleaver showed up, and by this point, so many people had shown up, they said family only. And so a close friend of Jerry's was with Jerry, you know, talking to him in the coma when this large African-American gentleman walked in and goes, who are you? He says, well, I'm Eldridge Cleaver. And they said, well, Eldridge, family only. He said, well, I told the woman at the nurse's station, I'm family. Tim Leary was there hovering over Jerry. There were even people who never met Jerry. A lot of, you know, sort of old hippies were coming and they were chanting and doing things. It was quite a circus there.
Weren't there some New Age attempts to help him with his recovery?
Well, yeah. There were people saying, wave this scarf, you know, say this three times and sprinkle basil on him and he'll wake up. I think Mimi and the family found that charming maybe the first 10 times. And then after that, it was like, you know what? This is a serious medical emergency. We need to keep these people at bay.
And Gil, he's buried in Culver City out in California?
I'm not sure exactly where.
I think he is. Strangely, the only thing I haven't done, I've done everything you can do about Jerry, including coming here to Cincinnati to honor him. I have not been to his gravesite.
But your parents, Gil,
are here in Cincinnati, correct.
And you said Covedale?
Covedale, correct.
They're here. I'm wondering why he didn't come back home.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to speak for anybody, but, you know, it had been so many years since Jerry had been in Cincinnati. You know, he saw himself as that point, a Los Angeles resident. Mm-hmm. It doesn't surprise me that he would be buried in Los Angeles.
And what about his kids? What are they up to?
Well, one is 30 and one is 27. His daughter, Juliet, is a very successful computer programmer and a hardcore vegan. His son, Adam, lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and does various things, a little bit of a wandering soul, but a really sweet kid.
Just a little bit here. I want to talk about some of the other projects that you've worked on. You did a photo exhibit of Les McCann.
Well, Les McCann is a famous jazz pianist, best known for a hit single called Compared to What in 1970. Les carried a camera around and took hundreds of photos in the 60s and 70s of Nina Simone, Aretha Franklin, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Stokely Carmichael, Martin Luther King. So I assembled a photo book of those great photos. That came out a few years ago. And then before that, I did a book about how the Black Panther Party intersected with some of these white radicals, how much they loved Dylan, just sort of talking about the pop culture elements of the Black Power movement. And all of these books were published by Fantagraphics Books, which is a publisher in Seattle.
And you also did a 3-CD set of Ginsberg?
Yeah. You know, I'm obviously obsessed with the counterculture. I met Ginsberg when I was in my 20s. A lot of people don't know this. Ginsberg, obviously famous as a poet, he fancied himself a singer. He recorded several albums with Bob Dylan and other people. And so I put together a 3-CD box set endorsed by the Ginsberg estate called First Blues, and it's Ginsy singing.
I've been in conversation with Pat Thomas and Gil Rubin. Pat's written a book called Did It From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. And I just want to say, since we're in Cincinnati, there's a strong regional aspect to this book. You know, Jerry was here in Cincinnati in the 50s and 60s. He was a reporter covering baseball games and campus events at UC. And so, you know, even if your interest in Jerry as a national figure is marginal, there's a great section in this book about Cincinnati in the 50s and 60s, what it was like to be in high school here, what it was like to be on campus, and I call it an oral and visual history. Lots of people like Gil speaking in their own voice, talking not just about Jerry, but, you know, this is really the arc of the baby boomers, which is that, you know, in the 60s, they were fighting against the war. in the 70s, maybe they were into health food, getting their degrees. In the 80s, they were working at IBM, trying to buy a house and get a couple of Mercedes in their parking lot. And so, you know, Jerry Rubin is very much a classic baby boomer story.
Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
You know it's true. Ashes to ashes, dirt to dirt. Love, work, and suffer is our sentence here on Earth, and ain't nobody getting out of here alive. So, whatsoever you may do, or howsoever great thou art, when it all ends up, baby, it's just like little Milton say, you got to go back to Mother Earth.
For Around Cincinnati, I'm Lee Hay.